Roll the tape, roll the tape. How do we know now? Did he do it or not? Beulah. Ingrid Christiansen. Flannery O'Connor. Revelation. There we go. The story is called Revelation. Are we ready? Thank you. Now we know.
Well,
it's a comedy.
This is a very serious story, you guys. I'm convinced that she named it Revelation after the book of Revelation, partly because the language she goes into toward the end is very much the language of the book of Revelation. But it's Flannery O'Connor was born in Georgia, and she was raised there, and it's a Southern story. She died when she was 39 of lupus, and she died in 1965. So it was written fairly late in her life. So it's a fairly contemporary story. I mean, some of you young folks may not think that's contemporary, but 65 to me seems quite a short while ago. And the story looks at ethical and religious questions. So in that sense, it's at least religiously based. A few things I want to mention before I read it, because I think it's hard to pick up on as much when you hear a story as you might if you read it and had a chance to look back over things. So just a few little things. The point of view is of a narrator who can see into the mind of the mother, the woman. And it's interesting because the narrator kind of comes and goes out of almost becoming the woman and then pulling back and watching the woman. So the narrator does that little bit of flowing, but basically that's what the narrator cannot see into the minds of anyone else except for the main character. The story looks at social class, and it examines the assumptions that there are. It tries to examine the assumption that social class is a meaningful way to talk about society, and it looks at gradations of people. It's very difficult for me to read parts of this story because among the classes is a class called nigger, and I can hardly say the word. It's really tough to read. She couldn't write this story in this time, in this place, in this state of the Union without using the word. I mean, it would be totally unrealistic. But just understand that I'm shuddering with you when we shudder using nigger. It's just tough to use. But it is a class among the social classes that she's looking at. She does an interesting little rhythm that you might want to pay attention to, which is between having her characters be extremely raunchy and inappropriately raunchy. You think you just sort of withdraw from them. And then having them do something kind of high-toned. And she sort of plays back and forth between those two things. And some little points. There is a very funny scene of black folks in here that I can barely read with a straight face. And they are shucking and jiving. They're making fun of their white master in this scene, and it'll be delightful. It'll release a lot of the tension that arises from the use of the word nigger. Then there is, in this story, as in the one that I read a couple days ago, there's a lot of play on light. She uses light and dark, in significant ways. And I think with those notes, I will proceed. I'm sorry that I have to leave out a bit of it, because it's too long, and I want to have more time to discuss. So I'm going to leave out a little bit, but I'll sort of summarize it for you when the time comes. Revelation. The doctors, sorry.
I don't know if I can hear at the same time that's going on, so.
Is it the kids in the kitchen that are?
Yeah.
You want to tell the kids they've got to shut it down? Thanks, Gary. The doctor's waiting room, which was very small, was almost full when the Turpins entered, and Mrs. Turpin, who was very large, made it look even smaller by her presence. She stood, looming at the head of the magazine table set in the center of it, a living demonstration that the room was inadequate and ridiculous. Her little bright black eyes took in all the patients as she sized up the seating situation. There was one vacant chair and a place on the sofa occupied by a blonde child in a dirty blue romper who should have been told to move over and make room for the lady. He was 5 or 6, but Mrs. Turpin saw at once that no one was going to tell him to move over. He was slumped down in the seat, his arms idle at his sides and his eyes idle in his head. His nose ran unchecked. Mrs. Turpin put a firm hand on Claude's shoulder and said in a voice that included anyone who wanted to listen, "Claude, you sit in that chair there," and gave him a push down into the vacant one. Claude was florid and bald and sturdy, somewhat shorter than Mrs. Turpin, but he sat down as if he were accustomed to doing what she told him to do. Mrs. Turpin remained standing. The only man in the room besides Claude was a lean, stringy old fellow with a rusty hand spread out on each knee, whose eyes were closed as if he were asleep or dead, or pretending to be so as not to get up and offer her his seat. Her gaze settled agreeably on a well-dressed, gray-haired lady whose eyes met hers and whose expression said, "If that child belonged to me, he would have some manners and move over. There's plenty of room there for you and him, too." Claude looked up with a sigh and made as if to rise. "Sit down," said Mrs. Turpin. "You know you're not supposed to stand on that leg." "He has an ulcer on his leg," she explained. Claude lifted his foot onto the magazine table and rolled up his trouser to reveal a purple swelling on a plump marble white calf. "My," the pleasant lady said, "how did you do that?" "A cow kicked him," Mrs. Turpin said. "Goodness," said the lady. Claude rolled his trouser leg down. And then we're going to skip a little bit here, which talks about the kid not moving over. Mrs. Turpin eased into the vacant chair, which held her tight as a corset. A man did get called into the doctor's office, so there was a chair vacated. "I wish I could reduce," she said, and rolled her eyes and gave a comic sigh. "Oh, you aren't fat," the stylish lady said. "Oh, I am too," Mrs. Turpin said. "Claude, he eats all he wants to and never weighs over 175 pounds. But me, I just look at something good to eat and I gain some weight." And her stomach and shoulders shook with laughter. "You can eat all you want to, can't you, Claude?" she asked, turning to him. Claude only grinned. "Well, as long as you have such a good disposition," the stylish lady said, "I don't think it makes a bit of difference what size you are. You just can't beat a good disposition." Next to her was a fat girl of 18 or 19, scowling into a deep blue book, which Mrs. Turpin saw was entitled Human Development. The girl raised her head and directed her scowl at Mrs. Turpin, as if she did not like her looks. She appeared annoyed that anyone should speak while she tried to read. The poor girl's face was blue with acne, and Mrs. Turpin thought how pitiful it was to have a face like that at that age. She gave the girl a friendly smile, but the girl only scowled the harder. Mrs. Turpin herself was fat, but she had always had good skin, and though she was 47 years old, there was not a wrinkle in her face except around her eyes from laughing too much. Next to the ugly girl was the child, still in exactly the same position, and next to him was a thin, leathery old woman in a cotton print dress. She and Claude had 3 sacks of chicken feed in their pump house that was in the same print. She had seen from the first that the child belonged to that old woman. She could tell by the way they sat, kind of vacant and white trashy, as if they could sit there until doomsday if nobody called them and told them to get up. And at right angles, but next to the well-dressed pleasant lady, was a lank-faced woman who was certainly the child's mother. She had on a yellow sweatshirt and wine-colored slacks, both gritty-looking, and the rims of her lips were stained with snuff. Her dirty yellow hair was tied behind with a little piece of red paper ribbon. Worse than niggers any day, Mrs. Turpin thought. A gospel hymn playing was, "When I looked up and he looked down," and Mrs. Turpin, who knew it, supplied the last line mentally. "And one of these days I know I'll wear a crown." Without appearing to, Mrs. Turpin always noticed people's feet. The well-dressed lady had on red and gray suede shoes to match her dress. Mrs. Turpin had on her good black patent leather pumps. The ugly girl had on Girl Scout shoes with heavy socks. The old woman had on tennis shoes, and the white, trashy mother had on what appeared to be bedroom slippers, black straw with gold braid threaded through them, exactly what you would have expected her to have on. Sometimes at night, when she couldn't get to sleep, Mrs. Turpin would occupy herself with a question of who she would have chosen to be if she couldn't have been herself. If Jesus had said to her before he made her, "There's only two places available for you. You can either be a nigger or a white trash," what would she have said? "Please, Jesus, please," she would have said. "Let me wait until there's another place available." And he would have said, "No, you have to go right now, and I only have those two places, so make up your mind." She would have wiggled and squirmed and begged and pleaded, but it would have been no use. And finally, she would have said, "All right, make me a nigger then, but that don't mean a trashy one." And he would have made her a neat, clean, respectable Negro woman herself, but black. Next to the child's mother was a red-headed youngish woman reading one of the magazines and working a piece of chewing gum, hell for leather, as Claude would say. Mrs. Turpin could not see the woman's feet. She was not white trash, just common. Sometimes Mrs. Turpin occupied herself at night naming the classes of people. On the bottom of the heap were most colored people. Not the kind she would have been if she'd been one, but most of them. Then, next to them, not above, just away from, were the white trash. Then above them were the homeowners, and above them were the home and land owners, to which she and Claude belonged. Above she and Claude were people with a lot of money and much bigger houses and much more land. But here, the complexity of it would begin to bear in on her, for some of the people with a lot of money were common and ought to be below she and Claude, and some of the people who had good blood had lost their money and had to rent. And then there were colored people who owned their homes and land as well. There was a colored dentist in town who had two red Lincolns and a swimming pool and a farm with registered white-faced cattle on it. Usually, by the time she'd fallen asleep, all the classes of people were mulling and rolling around in her head, and she would dream they were all crammed in together in a boxcar, being ridden off to be put in a gas oven. I'm going to skip a bit, which is some interaction of the people in the waiting room, all of which emphasizes the white trash and the nigger and the poor folk and the middle class folk kind of stereotypes. A young black boy comes in on a bicycle and delivers something, and he's real competent and clean and good and stuff, but he's a nigger. And then as soon as he leaves, they say, "They ought to send all them niggers back to Africa," the white trash woman said. "That's where they come from in the first place." "Oh, I couldn't do without my good colored friend," the pleasant lady said. "There's a heap of things worse than a nigger," Mrs. Turpin agreed. "It's all kinds of them, just like it's all kinds of us." "Yes, and it takes all kinds to make the world go round," the lady said in her musical voice. As she said it, the raw-complexioned girl snapped her teeth together. Her lower lip turned downward and inside out, revealing the pale pink inside her mouth. After a second, it rolled back up. It was the ugliest face Mrs. Turpin had ever seen anyone make, and for a moment she was certain the girl had made it at her. She was looking at her as if she'd known and disliked her all her life, all of Mrs. Turpin's life, it seemed, too, not just all the girl's life. "Why, girl, I don't even know you," Mrs. Turpin said silently. She forced her attention back to the discussion. "It wouldn't be practical to send them back to Africa," she said. "They wouldn't want to go. They got it too good here." "It wouldn't be what they wanted if I had anything to do with it," the white trash woman said. "It wouldn't be a way in the world you could get all the niggers back over there," Mrs. Turpin said. "They'd be hiding out and lying down and turning sick on you and wailing and hollering and raring and pitching. It wouldn't be a way in the world to get them over there." "They got the over here," the trashy woman said. "Get back like they got over." "It wasn't so many of them then," Mrs. Turpin explained. The woman looked at Mrs. Turpin as if here was an idiot indeed, but Mrs. Turpin was not bothered by the look, considering where it came from. No, she said, they're going to stay here where they can go to New York and marry white folk and improve their color. That's what they all want to do, every one of them, improve their color. You know what comes of that, don't you? Claude asked. No, Claude, what? Mrs. Turpin said. Claude's eyes twinkled. White-faced niggers, he said, with never a smile. Everybody in the office laughed, except the white trash and the ugly girl. The girl gripped the book in her lap with white fingers. The trashy woman looked around her from face to face as if she thought they were all idiots. The old woman in the feed sack dress continued to gaze expressionless across the floor at the high-top shoes of the man opposite her, the one who had been pretending to be asleep when the Turpins came in. He was laughing heartily, his hands still spread out on his knees. The child had fallen to the side and was lying now almost face down in the old woman's lap. When they recovered from their laughter, the nasal chorus on the radio kept the room from silence. You can go to blank blank and I'll go to mine, but we'll all blank along together, and all along the blank we'll help each other out, smiling in any kind of weather. Mrs. Turpin didn't catch every word, but she caught enough to agree with the spirit of the song, and it turned her thoughts sober. To help anybody out that needed it was her philosophy of life. She never spared herself when she found somebody in need, whether they were white or black, trash or decent. And of all she had to be thankful for, she was most thankful that this was so. If Jesus had said, you can be high society and have all the money you want and be thin and svelte-like, but you can't be a good woman with it, she would have had to say, well, don't make me that then. Make me a good woman, and it don't matter what else, how fat or how ugly or how poor. Her heart rose. He had not made her a nigger or white trash or ugly. He had made her herself and given her a little bit of everything. Jesus, thank you, she said. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Whenever she counted her blessings, she felt as buoyant as if she weighed 125 pounds instead of 180. What's wrong with your little boy? The pleasant lady asked the white trashy woman. He has an ulcer, the woman said proudly. He ain't given me a minute's peace since he was born. Him and her are just alike, he said, nodding at the old woman who was running her leathery fingers through the child's pale hair. Look like I can't get nothing down them two but Coca-Cola and candy. That's all you try to get down him, Mrs. Turpin said to herself. Too lazy to light the fire. There was nothing you could tell her about people like them that she didn't know already. And it was not just that they didn't have anything, because if you gave them everything in 2 weeks, it would all be broken or filthy, and they still would have chopped it up for firewood. She knew all this from her own experience. Help them you must, but help them you couldn't. All at once, the ugly girl turned her lips inside out again. Her eyes were fixed like two drills on Mrs. Turpin. This time there was no mistaking that there was something urgent behind them. Girl, Mrs. Turpin exclaimed silently, I haven't done a thing to you. The girl must be confusing her with somebody else. There was no need to sit by and let herself be intimidated. You must be in college, she said boldly, looking directly at the girl. I see you reading a book there. The girl continued to stare and pointedly did not answer. Her mother blushed at this rudeness. The lady asked you a question, Mary Grace, she said under her breath. I have ears, said Mary Grace. The poor mother blushed again. Mary Grace goes to Wellesley College, she explained. She twisted one of the buttons on her dress. In Massachusetts, she added with a grimace. And in the summer, she just keeps right on studying, just reads all the time, a real bookworm. She's done real well at Wellesley. She's taken English and math and history and psychology and social studies, she rattled on. And I think it's too much. I think she ought to get out and have fun. The girl looked as if she would like to hurl them all through the plate glass window. Way up north, Mrs. Turpin murmured and thought, well, it hadn't done much for her manners. I'd almost rather have him sick, the white trash woman said, wrenching the attention back to herself. He's so mean when he ain't. Look like some children just take natural to meanness. It's some gets bad when they get sick, but he was the opposite. Took sick and turned good. He don't give me no trouble now. It's just me waiting to see the doctor today, she said. If I was going to send anybody back to Africa, Mrs. Turpin thought, it would be your kind woman. Yes, indeed, she said aloud, but looking up at the ceiling. It's a heap of things worse than a nigger. And dirtier than a hog, she added to herself. I think people with bad dispositions are more to be pitied than anyone else on earth, the pleasant lady said in a voice that was decidedly thin. I thank the Lord he has blessed me with a good one, Mrs. Turpin said. The day has never dawned that I couldn't find something to laugh at. Not since she married me, anyways, Claude said with a comical straight stare. Everyone laughed except the girl and the white trash. Mrs. Turpin's stomach shook. He's such a caution, she said, that I can't help but laugh at him. The girl made a loud, ugly noise through her teeth. Her mother's mouth grew thin and tight. I think the worst thing in the world, she said, is an ungrateful person. To have everything and not appreciate it. I know a girl, she said, who has parents who would give her anything, a little brother who loves her dearly, who is getting a good education, who wears the best clothes, but who can never say a kind word to anyone, who never smiles, who just criticizes and complains all day long. Is she too old to paddle? Claude asked. The girl's face was almost purple. Yes, the lady said, I'm afraid there's nothing to do but leave her to her folly. Someday she'll wake up and it'll be too late. It never hurts anyone to smile, Mrs. Turpin said. It just makes you feel better all over. Of course, the lady said sadly, but there are just some people you can't tell anything to. They can't take criticism. If it's one thing I am, Mrs. Turpin said with feeling, it's grateful. When I think who all I could have been besides myself, and what all I got, a little of everything, and a good disposition besides, I just feel like shouting, thank you, Jesus, for making everything the way it is. It could have been different. For one thing, somebody else could have got Claude. At the thought of this, she was flooded with gratitude, and a terrible pang of joy ran through her. Oh, thank you, Jesus, Jesus, thank you, she cried aloud. The book struck her directly over her left eye. It struck almost at the same instant that she realized the girl was about to hurl it. Before she could utter a sound, the raw face came crashing across the table toward her, howling. The girl's fingers sank like clamps into the soft flesh of her neck. She heard the mother cry out and Claude shout, whoa! There was an instant when she was certain that she was about to be in an earthquake. All at once, her vision narrowed and she saw everything as if it were happening in a small room far away, or as if she were looking at it through the wrong end of a telescope. Claude's face crumpled and fell out of sight. The nurse ran in, then out, then in again. Then the gangling figure of the doctor rushed out of the inner door. Magazines flew this way and that as the table turned over. The girl fell with a thud, and Mrs. Turpin's vision suddenly reversed itself, and she saw everything large instead of small. The eyes of the white trashy woman were staring hugely at the floor. Then the girl, held down on one side by the nurse and on the other by her mother, was wrenching and turning in their grasp. The doctor was kneeling astride her, trying to hold her arm down. He managed, after a second, to sink a long needle into it. Mrs. Turpin felt entirely hollow except for her heart, which swung from side to side as if it were agitated in a great empty drum of flesh. Somebody that's not busy, call for the ambulance, the doctor said in an offhand voice young doctors adopt for terrible occasions. Mrs. Turpin could not have moved a finger. The old man who'd been sitting next to her skipped nimbly into the office and made the call, for the secretary still seemed to be gone. Claude, Mrs. Turpin called. He was not in his chair. She knew she must jump up and find him, but she felt like someone trying to catch a train in a dream when everything moves in slow motion and the faster you try to run, the slower you go. Here I am, a suffocated voice, very unlike Claude's, said. He was doubled up in the corner on the floor, pale as paper, holding his leg. She wanted to get up and go to him, but she could not move. Instead, her gaze was drawn slowly downward to the churning face on the floor, which she could see over the doctor's shoulder. The girl's eyes stopped rolling and focused on her. They seemed a much lighter blue than before, as if a door that had been tightly closed behind them was now open to admit light and air. Mrs. Turpin's head cleared and her power of motion returned. She leaned forward until she was looking directly into the brilliant, fierce eyes. There was no doubt in her mind that the girl did know her, knew her in some intense and personal way, beyond time and place and condition. "What you got to say to me?" she asked hoarsely and held her breath, waiting, as for a revelation. The girl raised her head, her gaze locked with Mrs. Turpin's. "Go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog," she whispered. Her voice was low but clear. Her eyes burned for a moment as if she saw with pleasure that her message had struck its target. Mrs. Turpin sank back in her chair. After a moment, the girl's eyes closed and she turned her head wearily to the side. The doctor rose and handed the nurse the empty syringe. He leaned over and put both hands for a moment on the mother's shoulders, which were shaking. She was sitting on the floor, her lips pressed together, holding Mary Grace's hand in her lap. The girl's fingers were gripped like a baby's around her thumb. "Go on to the hospital," he said. "I'll call and make the arrangements." "Now let's see that neck," he said in a jovial voice to Mrs. Turpin. He began to inspect her neck with his first two fingers. Two little moon-shaped lines like pink fish bones were indented over her windpipe. There was the beginning of an angry red swelling above her eye. His fingers passed over this also. "Leave me be," she said thickly and shook him off. "See about Claude. She kicked him." "I'll see about him in a minute," he said, and felt her pulse. He was a thin, gray-haired man, given to pleasantries. "Go home and have yourself a vacation the rest of the day," he said, and patted her on the shoulder. "Quit your patting me," Mrs. Turpin growled to herself. "And put an ice pack over that eye," he said. Then he went and squatted down beside Claude and looked at his leg. After a moment, he pulled him up, and Claude limped after him into the office. Until the ambulance came, the only sounds in the room were the tremulous moans of the girl's mother, who continued to sit on the floor. The white trash woman did not take her eyes off the girl. Mrs. Turpin looked straight ahead at nothing. Presently, the ambulance drew up, a long, dark shadow behind the curtain. The attendants came in and set the stretcher down beside the girl and lifted her expertly onto it and carried her out. The nurse helped the mother gather up her things. The shadow of the ambulance moved silently away, and the nurse came back in the office. "That there girl's going to be a lunatic, ain't she?" the white trash woman asked the nurse, but the nurse kept on to the back and never answered her. "Yep, she's going to be a lunatic," the white trash woman said to the rest of them. "Poor critter," the old woman murmured. The child's face was still in her lap. His eyes looked idly out over her knees. He had not moved during the disturbance except to draw one leg up under him. "Ah, thank God," the white trash woman said fervently. "I ain't a lunatic." Claude came limping out and the Turpins went home. As their pickup truck turned into their own dirt road and made the crest of the hill, Mrs. Turpin gripped the window ledge and looked out suspiciously. The land sloped gracefully down through the field dotted with lavender weeds, and at the start of the rise, their small yellow frame house, with its little flower bed spread out around it like fancy apron, sat primly in its accustomed place between two giant hickory trees. She would not have been startled to see a burnt wound between the two blackened chimneys. Neither of them felt like eating, so they put on their house clothes and lowered the shade in the bedroom and lay down, Claude with his leg on a pillow and herself with a damp washcloth over her eye. The instant she was flat on her back, the image of a razor-backed hog with warts on its face and horns coming out behind its ears snorted into her head. She moaned, a low, quiet moan. "I am not," she said tearfully, "a warthog from hell." But the denial had no force. The girl's eyes and her words, even the tone of her voice, low but clear, directed only to her, broked no repudiation. She had been singled out for the message, though there was trash in the room to whom it might justly have been applied. The full force of this fact struck her only now. There was a woman there who was neglecting her own child, but she had been overlooked. The message had been given to Ruby Turpin, a respectable, hard-working, church-going woman. The tears dried. Her eyes began to burn instead with wrath. She rose on her elbows, and the washcloth fell into her hand. Claude was lying on his back, snoring. She wanted to tell him what the girl had said. At the same time, she did not wish to put the image of herself as a warthog from hell into his mind. "Hey, Claude," she muttered and pushed his shoulder. Claude opened one pale baby blue eye. She looked into it warily. He did not think about anything. He just went his way. What's it?" he said and closed his eye again. "Nothing," she said. "How does your leg pain you?" "Hurts like hell," Claude said. "It'll quit directly," she said, and lay back down. In a moment, Claude was snoring again. For the rest of the afternoon, they lay there. Claude slept. She scowled at the ceiling. Occasionally, she raised her fist and made a small stabbing motion over her chest as if she was defending her innocence to invisible guests who were like the comforters of Job, reasonable-seeming but wrong. About 5:30, Claude stirred. "Got to go after those niggers," he said, not moving. The part we missed, they talked about having to go out to the field and fetch their niggers and bring them in, and that Mrs. Turpin would bring out a bucket of ice water for them. She was looking straight up as if there was something unintelligible handwriting on the ceiling. The protuberance over her eye had turned a greenish-blue. "Listen here," she said. "What?" "Kiss me." Claude leaned over and kissed her loudly on the mouth. He pinched her side and interlocked. Her expression of ferocious concentration did not change. Claude got up, groaning and growling, and limped off. She continued to study the ceiling. She did not get up until she heard the pickup truck coming back with the Negroes. Then she rose and thrust her feet into her brown Oxfords, which she did not bother to lace, and stumped out onto the back porch and got her red plastic bucket. She emptied a tray of ice cubes into it and filled it half full of water and went out into the backyard. Every afternoon, after Claude had brought the hands in, one of the boys helped him put out hay, and the rest waited in the back of the truck until he was ready to take them home. The truck was parked in the shade under one of the hickory trees. "Hi, y'all, this evening," Miss Turpin asked grimly, appearing with a bucket and the dipper. There were three women and a boy in the truck. "Us doing nicely," the oldest woman said. "Hi, how you doing?" And her gaze immediately stuck on the dark lump on Mrs. Turpin's forehead. "You done fell down, ain't you?" she asked in a solicitous voice. The old woman was dark and almost toothless. She had on an old felt hat of Claude's set back on her head. The other two women were younger and lighter, and they both had new bright green sun hats. One of them had hers on her head, the other one had taken hers off, and the boy was grinning beneath it. Mrs. Turpin set the bucket down on the floor of the truck. "Y'all help yourselves," she said. She looked around to make sure Claude had gone. "No, I didn't fall down," she said, folding her arms. "It was something worse than that." "Ain't nothing bad happened to you," the old woman said. She said it as if they knew that Mrs. Turpin was protected in some special way by divine providence. "You just had you a little fall." "We were in town at the doctor's office for where the cow kicked Mr. Turpin," Mrs. Turpin said in a flat tone that indicated they could leave off their foolishness. "And there was this girl there, a big fat girl with her face all broke out. I could look at that girl and tell she was peculiar, but I couldn't tell how. And me and her mama were just talking and going along, and all of a sudden, wham, she throws this big book she was reading at me, and, nah," the old woman cried out. "And then she jumps over the table and commences to choke me." "Nah," they all exclaimed, "no." "How come she do that?" the old woman asked. "What ail her?" Mrs. Turpin only glared in front of her. "Something ail her," the old woman said. "They carried her off in an ambulance," Mrs. Turpin continued, "but before she went, she was rolling on the floor, and they were trying to hold her down and give her a shot, and she said something to me." She paused. "You know what she said to me?" "What'd she say?" they asked. "She said," Mrs. Turpin began and stopped, her face very dark and heavy. The sun was getting whiter and whiter, blanching the sky overhead so that the leaves of the hickory tree were black in the face of it. She could not bring forth the words. "Something real ugly," she muttered. "She's shown up, shouldn't have said nothing ugly to you," said the old woman. "You so sweet, you the sweetest lady I know." "She pretty, too," the one with the hat on said. "And stout," the other one said. "I never knowed no sweeter white lady." "That's the truth before Jesus," the old woman said. "Amen. You just as sweet and pretty as you can be." Mrs. Turpin knew just exactly how much Negro flattery was worth, and it added to her rage. She said, she began again and finished this time with a fierce rush of breath, "that I was an old warthog from hell." There was an astounded silence. "Where's she at?" the youngest woman cried in a piercing voice. "Let me see her. I'll kill her. I'll kill her with you," the other one cried. "She belong in the asylum," the old woman said emphatically. "You the sweetest white lady I know." "She pretty, too," the other two said. "Stout."
She stout.
"Stout as she can be and sweet. Jesus satisfied with her." "'Deed he is," the old woman declared. "Idiots," Mrs. Turpin growled to herself. "You could never say anything intelligent to a nigger. You could talk at them, but not with them. Y'all ain't drunk your water," she said shortly. "Leave the bucket in the truck when you've finished with it. I got more to do than just stand around and pass the time of day." And she moved off into the house. She stood for a moment in the middle of the kitchen. The dark protuberance over her eye looked like a miniature tornado cloud which might at any moment sweep across the horizon of her brow. Her lower lip protruded dangerously. She squared her massive shoulders. Then she marched into the house and out the side door and started down the road to the pig parlor. She had the look of a woman going single-handed, weaponless, into battle. You missed the part about the pig parlor. It's a cement platform that the pigs live on, and it gets hosed off every day. The sun was a deep yellow now, like a harvest moon, and was riding westward very fast over the far tree line as if it meant to reach the hogs before she did. The road was rutted, and she kicked several good-sized stones out of her path as she strode along. The pig parlor was on a little knoll at the end of a lane that ran off from the side of the barn. It was a square of concrete as large as a small room, with a board fence about 4 feet high around it. The concrete floor sloped slightly so that the hogwash could drain off into a trench where it was carried to the field for fertilizer. Claude was standing on the outside, on the edge of the concrete, hanging onto the top board, hosing down the floor inside. The hose was connected to the faucet of a water trough nearby. Mrs. Turpin climbed up beside him and glowered down at the hogs inside. There were 7 long-snouted, bristly shoats in it, tan with liver-colored spots, and an old sow a few weeks off from farrowing. She was lying on her side, grunting. The shoats were running about, shaking themselves like idiot children, their little slit pig eyes searching the floor for anything left. She had read that pigs were the most intelligent animal. She doubted it. They were supposed to be smarter than dogs. There had even been a pig astronaut. He had performed his assignment perfectly, but died of a heart attack afterward because they left him in his electric suit, sitting upright throughout his examination, when naturally a hog should be on all fours. A gruntin' and a rootin' and a groanin'. "Give me that hose," she said, yanking it away from Claude. "Go on and carry them niggers home, and then get off that leg." "You look like you might have swallowed a mad dog," Claude observed, but he got down and limped off. He paid no attention to her humors. Until he was out of earshot, Mrs. Turpin stood on the side of the pen, holding the hose and pointing the stream of water at the hindquarters of any shoat that looked as if it might try to lie down. When he had had time to get over the hill, she turned her head slightly, and her wrathful eyes scanned the path. He was nowhere in sight. She turned back again and seemed to gather herself up. Her shoulders rose, and she drew in her breath. "What do you send me a message like that for?" she said in a low, fierce voice, barely above a whisper, but with the force of a shout in its concentrated fury. "How am I a hog and me both? How am I saved and from hell, too?" Her free fist was knotted, and with the other she gripped the hose, blindly pointing the stream of water in and out of the eye of the old sow, whose outraged squeal she did not hear. The pig parlor commanded a view of the back pasture, where their 20 beef cows were gathered around the hay bales Claude and the boys had put out. The freshly cut pasture sloped down the highway. Across it was their cotton field, and beyond that a dark green, dusty wood, which they owned as well. The sun was behind the wood, very red, looking over the paling of trees like a farmer inspecting his own hogs. "Why me?" she rumbled. "It's no trash around here, black or white, that I haven't given to. And break my back to the bone every day working, and do for the church?" She appeared to be the right-sized woman to command the arena before her. "How am I a hog?" she demanded. "Exactly how am I like them?" And she jabbed the stream of water at the shoats. "There was plenty of trash there. It didn't have to be me." "If you like trash better, go get yourself some trash then," she railed. "You could have made me trash. Or a nigger. If trash is what you wanted, why didn't you make me trash?" She shook her fist with a hose in it, and a watery snake appeared momentarily in the air. "I could quit working and take it easy and be filthy," she growled, "lounge about the sidewalks all day drinking root beer, dip snuff and spit in every puddle and have it all over my face. I could be nasty. Or you could have made me a nigger." "It's too late for me to be a nigger," she said with deep sarcasm, "but I could act like one, lay down in the middle of the road and stop traffic, roll on the ground." In the deepening light, everything was taking on a mysterious hue. The pasture was growing a peculiar glassy green, and the streak of highway had turned lavender. She braced herself for a final assault, and this time her voice rolled out over the pasture. "Go on," she yelled. "Call me a hog. Call me a hog again, from hell. Call me a warthog from hell. Put that bottom rail on top. There'll still be a top and a bottom." A garbled echo returned to her. A final surge of fury shook her, and she roared, "Who do you think you are?" The color of everything, field and crimson sky, burned for a moment with a transparent intensity. The question carried over the pasture and across the highway in the cotton field and returned to her clearly, like an answer, from beyond the wood. She opened her mouth, but no sound came out of it. A tiny truck, Claude's, appeared on the highway, heading rapidly out of sight. Its gears scraped thinly. It looked much like a child's toy. At any moment, a bigger truck might smash into it and scatter Claude's and the nigger's brains all over the road. Mrs. Turpin stood there, her gaze fixed on the highway, all her muscles rigid, until in 5 or 6 minutes the truck reappeared, returning. She waited until it had had time to turn into their own road. Then, like a monumental statue coming to life, she bent her head slowly and gazed, as if through the very heart of mystery, down into the pig parlor at the hogs. They had settled all in one corner around the old sow, who was grunting softly. A red glow suffused them. They appeared to pant with a secret life. Until the sun finally slipped behind the tree line, Mrs. Turpin remained there, with her gaze bent to them, as if she were absorbing some abysmal life-giving knowledge. At last she lifted her head. There was only a purple streak in the sky, cutting through a field of crimson and leading like an extension of the highway into the descending dusk. She raised her hands from the side of the pen in a gesture hieratic and profound. A visionary light settled in her eyes. She saw the streak as a vast swinging bridge extending upward from the earth through a field of living fire. Upon it, a vast horde of souls were rumbling toward heaven. There were whole companies of white trash, clear for the first time in their lives, and bands of black niggers in white robes, and battalions of freaks and lunatics shouting and clapping and leaping like frogs. And bringing up the end of the procession was a tribe of people whom she recognized as once as those who, like herself and Claude, had always had a little of everything and the God-given wit to use it right. She leaned forward to observe them closer. They were marching behind the others with great dignity, accountable as they had always been for good order and common sense and respectable behavior. They alone were on key. Yet she could see by their shocked and altered faces that even their virtues were being burned away. She lowered her hands and gripped the rail of the hog pen, her eyes small but fixed unblinkingly on what lay ahead. In a moment, the vision faded, but she remained where she was, immobile. At length, she got down and turned off the faucet and made her slow way on the darkening path to the house. In the woods around her, the invisible cricket chorus had struck up, but what she heard were the voices of the souls climbing upward into the starry field and shouting, "Hallelujah!" Isn't that amazing? Woo, what did she have in mind there? She was... That just floors me every time I read it, that vision of, from Revelation at the end with all those souls rising up, and then the good, straight, hard-working people with their virtues burning away and falling off them. Mrs. Turpin plays God, in a sense, through much of the story. She judges. I wrote down a list at one point of all the people she judges. Let's see if I can find it. I guess I can't. But she or someone judges niggers, white trash, you know, poor folk. And then you're the worst if you're not grateful. Remember, the person without gratitude is declared to have been the worst. And then if you don't have a cheerful spirit, if you're not happy, you're the worst. If you're ugly, the girl with the purple face and the lips that kept turning out was declared to be the worst because she was ugly at one point. So there were lots of people who were the worst that Mrs. Turpin stood in judgment over, and felt good because she was benevolent. She gave to them. She gave to anybody. She prided herself in giving to anybody. But toward the end, I have a sense that that changes. Do you share that feeling? Does that, do you have anything to say about that? Does she remain in a position of judging and being God throughout? Is she...
She feels judged.
She certainly feels judged.
It's almost as if her standard of judgment is taken away. When, you know, she was sort of using herself always. There seems to be allusion to the Pharisee in the temple. "God, I thank you, you didn't make me like those people."
Mm-hmm.
And then when she's called this ugly thing, her benchmark is moving.
I feel she felt terrible when the lunatic nailed her. And that really identified her as being, perhaps this, she thought in her mind, this person really can see through all of this. Almost a revelation right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, she heard it as a voice from God because she went out and screamed, "How dare you? What are you, who do you think you are calling me?"
Mm-hmm. Why do you think she took it so hard?
Because it fits. Mm-hmm. When the shoe fits, it hurts worse.
Or part of her judgmental part is, I mean, I think people have a tendency to be judgmental when they are trying to build themselves up and feel better about themselves. And suddenly she was right there, you know, with all of the people that she didn't, seeing the people just like her coming down at the end with all their virtues going on, and suddenly that she just didn't have any of that. There's almost nothing to lift her above all of those people that she had kind of continuously looked down on and was so good to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe that was what
mm-hmm. got to her at the end.
And the accusation came from the person she had deemed the worst.
She had deemed the worst in the room at various times, the white trash woman and the black kid that I didn't read you, the messenger that came in, and the ugly girl, the college student. I think those were all that she thought were the worst, but in each case she thanked God afterwards that she wasn't plagued with whatever that person had. Why do you think that Flannery O'Connor gave that powerful voice to that college student? I mean, all we know about the student is that the student turned more and more purple throughout all this discourse and had bad skin and could make effective, terrifying faces.
Something intriguing about, quote, insanity. I went to the mental hospital one summer. And there were people there on the ward I thought were more sane than most of the staff.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because a lot of them had more insight mm-hmm. into the truth. Just they couldn't manage socially.
Mm-hmm.
And that insight, this is what I say about the so-called lunatic hitting her with the book. This person knew exactly she was the warthog from hell. I mean, it was just that identity was real for that person. Now, whether that person has some special insight, I don't know, but that's the way it struck me.
We're certainly led to think that that person is very smart.
Yeah, but there's something, it's like the idiot savant. It's like the person who can play piano but can't speak or is ignorant. There are parts of people's brains that are more tuned, and this can happen.
I guess I interpreted the book as shut up. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, for me, it was real painful. And it was just all this really lonely person who was in one sense saying her husband's totally incompetent because every time there would be a question, she'd answer it.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was at that point saying, thank God that, you know, got clawed before she gets hit. And that's what struck me is she being hit because this gal just saying shut up, or in fact picking up so much pain from this woman and her loneliness, her two-facedness or something, that she had to strike out against.
What else do we know? The book was named Human Development that she threw. And we know that this young woman goes to one of the Seven Sisters colleges. You know, it's a college that's tough to get into. You got to be smart. And we know that she's a good student and succeeding in college. We know that when people in that waiting room would tell stories that were particularly racist, that her... What?
She didn't laugh.
She didn't laugh. Her knuckles got white. She gripped the chair. She was suffering, I think, that college student. Clearly, I mean, she was really... She was also possessed, in some sense, it seemed like.
I was thinking that she was also felt a victim of... After all, someone with severe acne is often feel victimized
mm-hmm.
in society.
Mm-hmm.
And she probably identified with the blacks.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that we can go too far toward making her an angel, but I think she had some redeeming features, certainly. She was not cast as a black in the sense of negative or a scary person. She was cast as a person that had...
The truth.
Maybe.
She had the truth. She knew what truth was. That's why when she heard the falsehoods, her knuckles got white.
And whenever anybody blatantly lied, like you pointed out about her feelings about Claude.
It was not true, therefore, but she was unable to speak up at the time. And so the rage was within her until finally it exploded in the book and the statue. The truth had to come out.
And it was a great release of tension. I mean, everybody loved it when the book hit.
How often we wanted to do that ourselves?
I wonder if, because of her appearance, because she was from the South, going to school in the North, if she experienced rejection and the kinds of things that she heard this woman talking about and had developed some empathy for people who were outcasts.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't truth often rejected?
Mm-hmm. No, those are good comments. I think that's...
It's real interesting that the field hands also thought she was a lunatic. Or at least they said she was a lunatic because what she was doing was disrupting the order.
Mm-hmm.
And whether they believe that this woman who got hit with the book was sweet, the sweetest white person they ever knew, that was the game.
Mm-hmm.
And when she threw the book, she called the game.
Yeah, what did you make of that scene when they were all...
It's a wonderful scene.
It's a wonderful scene.
That was a book killer.
That's wonderful. They all just knew the role they had to play. Yeah, they knew where their ice water came from.
And then her comment about she knew how valuable it was, it made her even angrier.
Yeah.
They all knew the game they were playing. Yeah.
Absolutely, they knew. And the social order had been broken when that book flew through the air. And that the woman who, we learned very directly all the land she owns some of this, some of that. They have some money, and they are employers. And when that is all challenged, that was really dangerous, scary to them, I think.
Yeah, we work with them. We run into these insecure, rationalizing, despicable kinds of people like she was, and what a way to get at them. What a way to get at them through this little piece of artwork. We terror her out, and we bring her, we just deal with these people in our congregations all the time. And,
mm-hmm.
and it's just self-righteous, and we don't know how best to, we just wonder how in the world can we ever help these people.
Watch how he uses his
own right
from now on.
What a work of art.
She just flat out says, okay, you think the world is hierarchical? Let's look at it. Let's look at the hierarchy. She looks at, she has, here I found my list. Bad people are ugly, white trash, poor, black, bad dispositions, unkind, unpleasant, ungrateful person, lunatics. And she says, can we sort this out? Can we put everybody in their niche? And she ends up saying, no. There's one real turning point where the white trash woman says, well, at least I ain't a lunatic. I'm grateful I'm not a lunatic. So then she is someone to look down at. And it's almost a circle, everyone pointing at the next person and saying, that person's worse than I am. But then in the end, when she's yelling at God, it all strips away, and then she stops playing the role of God. She falls out of that role for the last couple paragraphs, and she is much more a child of God, along with everybody else. She's going to have some trouble adjusting to that. She's not going to like it, but that warthog has really gotten to her, and that message is, come on in. So I think she's changed by the end. I think this woman goes through a real change. Do you think that Flannery O'Connor is saying she's a bad woman?
No.
Mm-mm.
But she's finally been confronted with what she is. It's
mm-hmm.
like we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves. But then if you went out in the congregation and said, okay, let's name our sins, I doubt that we would all start naming them, because mm-hmm. we would say, well, no, I'm this way because of this or that or the other thing. On one hand, we say we have no sin, and we deceive ourselves if we say that, but on the other hand, we're not willing to admit it.
Mm-hmm.
I think here she's confronted with,
mm-hmm.
this is what I am.
And remember, the title of the story is Revelation. It was revealed to her. Did you say she has...
Well, I'm still mulling over the fact that you said that she was playing God, or she was God, I think is the word you used. And I think your analogy is good up to a point.
Yeah, it's limited.
God does judge us, but he judges us out of love. She judged others, but not out of love.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we had here was because I do not love myself, I am but a clanging cymbal or a gong, what is it, 1 Corinthians 13. And so that's what she was, bang, 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 noise, and not able to love others. And then I think toward the end, she realized the truth, and the metamorphosis goes into effect, and she does become maybe not more loving, but aware of the fact that love was important in her life.
Yeah.
I don't know what this business of stripping away the virtues, but because I didn't quite understand that. But.
Well, unfortunately, this is much more complicated than we have time to deal with now. It's sort of frustrating, but I think we've looked at some of the bones of it, and I appreciate your comments. I think they're very insightful.
I have a lady in the congregation that's is dying of this ALS disease, Lou Gehrig's thing.
Uh-huh.
Just 40 years old.
Ooh.
And she is kind of like this lady, has people categorized. And then one day, what I do is I go over, and I was reading a book to her, we got into this particular thing, and then the only way we communicate, she has a computer. And communicating to me that, you know, she was better than all of these other people.
Oh.
And I said, where in the world do you get the idea that you're better than anybody else? And then, some people are here, we may be here, but it's none of this and none of this, you know, we're here, you know. And then, where do you get the idea that you're better than somebody else? She's still processing that. Her mouth dropped.
Uh-huh.
And it stayed there for a long time.
Yeah,
so she's
good.
Still processing.
Give her the story.
Oh, yeah, that would
thank
be a good
you.
One for
thank
her.
You. Thank you.
Tomorrow, I have to do a short story about a Chinese woman.
Yeah. By Flannery?
No. Amy Tan. And what time are you doing that?
I think it's at 4. I think it's 4:50.
I think it's 6:50 because we're not against each other tomorrow.
Oh, good.
And I think I'm at 4.
Oh, okay, fine.
Good.
Because I was glad.
Yes, thank you.
That's one of the readers that.
Did you bring your
Noah
Palmer?
Ruth? No.
Did you bring your
no, I didn't.
Isn't that Palmer?
Anyway.